You know that feeling when your day finally slows down and you just want to relax, unplug, and feel good? That's where Mood.com comes in. They're changing the game, delivering legal THC products right to your door, no shady dealers, and absolutely no medical card required, just good vibes and better sleep, shipped straight from their farm to your couch. From delicious THC gummies, smooth vape pens, to premium THC flower, Mood has it all. And everything's federally legal under the 2018 Farm Bill. Yeah, this isn't some loophole. It's the real deal. Head to Mood.com and use code FIRST20 for 20% off your first order. That's MOOD.com. Find your mood.
Welcome to Indoctrination, a weekly conversation series about protecting yourself from systems of control. I'm your host, Rachel Bernstein.
Trust. It's the foundation of every meaningful relationship, but how do you know when it's real and when it's not? In this exclusive two-part series, I'll help you understand what real trust looks like and how to spot the signs of betrayal before it's too late. Whether it's family, friendship, romance, or work, Trust, the complete series, gives you the tools to protect your peace and better build connections. In part one, I focus on the foundational principles of trust, explaining how it affects your freedom and your emotional well-being, while also discussing the impact of betrayal, which is so devastating. In part two, I dive deeper into identifying subtle signs of trustworthiness, whether it's with family or friends or romantic partners or even colleagues. This lecture series and more are available for purchase on my website, rachelbernsteintherapy.com. Just follow the link in the description of this episode to view and purchase all of the available lecture videos there. Take good care. Hello, everyone. In this interview today, Kari and Kyle Hanks share their experience growing up in the 2x2s. A religious group also known as The Truth or The Way had a couple of names. They described the group's teachings, the social norms, and a culture where asking questions was discouraged. That is actually not new, but it's very frustrating, and it's hard to get a sense of what is really happening and to master any kind of information that you might need to master. And maybe that's why you're not allowed to ask questions. Kyle and Kari explain how the COVID-19 pandemic became a catalyst for them to begin deconstructing their faith and challenging long-held beliefs. The couple speaks about their journey, including Kari's discovery of her atheism and bisexuality and how it impacted their marriage. They also discuss the emotional and psychological struggles they faced, including all the feelings of guilt and anxiety and the threat of harm for questioning the group's teachings. The discussion shifts to the creation of a Facebook support group for ex-members alongside last week's guests, Mike and Abby Prosek. The Facebook group has grown significantly and helped many people come forward with their own stories and particularly around abuse in the 2x2s. This support network also played a key role in making a child abuse scandal within the group go public. Their work aims to provide a safe space for survivors and to foster a sense of community for those leaving restrictive religious environments. I look forward to having you hear my conversation with Kari and Kyle Hanks now. I'm so happy to be able to have Kari and Kyle Hanks with me today because there is a lot to talk about. And The audience listening today has already heard an interview with the Prusaks, who are talking about the two by twos or the truth and so many other names that it goes by. And so I'll let you know, just for frame of reference, something that I let them know, which is that when I first started doing this work as a counselor in the late 80s, the two by twos or whatever it was going by and whatever people were calling it, but basically that group was one that I was hearing about then. And then it kind of went dark. People just didn't talk about it. And now there's this explosion. Sometimes all it takes is for somebody to come forward. And then other people will say, it's like the Me Too movement.
Exactly.
And it is very important because people will say that to me, like, I wanted to come forward, but I didn't want to be the only voice, or I didn't want to be the first one. And so it really is empowering for people to be able to say, oh my goodness, it wasn't just me, or I'm not going to be the only voice out there and more easily attacked because I'm the only voice. So there is strength in numbers. And so I think that's so much of what's happening now, that people are feeling not even just emboldened, but safer to come forward. So I want to welcome you to the show and have you tell our audience a little bit about yourself. So, Kari, take it away.
Yeah, thanks so much for having us on. We really appreciate the opportunity to talk to you. So, I'm fourth generation on both sides of my family. So, I was born and raised in the two by twos. And growing up, we did not call it the two by twos. We didn't know that was a thing. Occasionally, a worker would preach and say, some people say we're called the two by twos, but we're not a piece of wood. If it came up at all, it was a name that was highly discouraged. Called ourselves the truth, the way. We're not a religion. We're not Christians. We're a way of life. On both sides of my family, goes back to my great grandparents. And one thing that we've noticed, particularly in our support group, a story that comes up a lot again and again with conversion stories, and this is true in my family as well, is that oftentimes our ancestors were going through a difficult time in their lives that made them very vulnerable. And then they get a knock on the door and it's these ministers traveling two by two workers. The workers are the ministers saying, we have all the answers and we know how to help you. And it's a pretty package tied with a pink bow that they hand these people with all of the answers that they're looking for. And that was the case, I think, with my great-grandparents when they heard the gospel, as they would call it. One of them had lost a farm in the Dust Bowl in Canada. One of them was a German immigrant who didn't speak the language and probably felt very lost and alone. One of them had lost a baby. So they were all going through these difficult times, and that the workers show up and they believed this is the way it is in Matthew 10. This is the one true way. Yeah, so it was handed down to me. And I never questioned it. It was completely normalized for me. So I was pretty hardy in it growing up.
A good word.
I was very jealous.
Jealous, yeah.
Did all of the things that I was supposed to do, checked all the boxes, looked the part, said the right things. I'm sure Mike and Abby explained some of how women in particular are expected to look in the two by twos. No makeup, no jewelry, no cutting hair, skirts and dresses. And I grew up next door to Kyle's aunt and uncle and his cousin, who was and is still one of my best friends. So we've known each other literally since I was born. He's 3 years older than me.
Okay. It's incredible. Wow.
Yeah.
Couple things that I want to say first. Yeah, fourth generation on both sides. So right, it was a way of life. It was your life. It was your whole community, your way of thinking, your way of talking, I'm sure too, and relating to the world, thinking about the world. It permeates everything. You mentioned quoting Matthew. What is that verse?
Matthew 10 is when Jesus sent out his disciples two by two, and they were supposed to leave behind their families and their belongings. He said, take no purse, take no script. And that was, I think, what they refer to as the first commission. I'm not religious anymore, but that's what we were taught as 2x2s, that the workers follow that chapter. So the religion is based on the ministry and the workers going 2x2, giving up everything they have, living in people's homes, which means they're staying in homes where children are present. They're expected to stay celibate, never marry, never have a family. So that creates a lot of problems right off the bat.
Absolutely right. It's an interesting thing too, listening to this, and Kyle, for sure you're going to get a chance to introduce yourself. I'm just jumping in because there's so much to talk about already. When we hear about so much now about the Gospels and the New Testament, there have been a lot of people now who are scholars, who are biblical scholars, who are language scholars, who are talking about how things have been translated or mistranslated, which is true for, I think, every Bible or every tradition too, where languages have changed or there have been translations of the work. And I was listening to this person who I've talked a little bit about on the podcast, who is a biblical scholar, not religiously so, but linguistically so. And he was noticing that the word given to Mary was that she was a virgin, but actually the word was not that she was a virgin. That it doesn't mean virgin, it means she was a young woman. There's so much. And that Eve didn't come from Adam's rib. Eve was this person on the side, kind of an equal. Like, well, what? That blows your mind. And that also, when we think about this idea that in Jesus's name, or that Jesus would send out people 2x2 to proselytize, basically, Jesus being Jewish, proselytization is against Jewish law. So it would not have happened. So you're like, okay, I don't even know how to make sense of the origin story of things, because so much was built on all of this. And you're wondering, okay, we lived this life. And I think of all the things I was taught and the Red Sea parting, like, I'm not sure of that. And maybe so much of it is allegory and all of that. But that when you're taught this is the word and this is the word of God, then you make a lot of decisions around that. And it forms the basis of what you believe. And then when you start taking it apart, it can feel liberating, but it can also feel overwhelming and disorienting. And also, I was thinking yesterday, it's something when I was actually interviewing the Prusaks yesterday, even though these episodes won't be coming out one day after the other, probably a week apart, I was thinking about people having to dress a certain way, and that when people then leave an organization, how they assert their independence in how they look and what they wear or what they don't wear. And there was a woman one time who had been a sister wife in the FLDS church, and her husband didn't like the color pink for whatever reason, and she was never allowed to wear pink. And she came into my office. She had a sweater over a shirt, and it was buttoned up to here, and she said, "Can I show you something?" And she started undoing the sweater, and there was a pink shirt underneath. And I think people would not know just how bold, like, it's a
so brave,
huge yeah. statement. And she was kind of nervous to even be wearing it, and she kind of had to hide it, she felt, from the world. So she wasn't ready, as though people would know or even think why she's wearing pink. But to her, it was this monumental shouting from the mountaintops, "I'm free." And so there are a lot of those moments that can go unnoticed by the general public, but that you know and people in your community know how big it is.
Yeah, the first time I wore a necklace outside of the house, Kyle and I were going to go to a restaurant, and I was like, "I'm going to wear a necklace." And I put it on and got in the car, and I couldn't get out of the car. I had a panic attack, so afraid that I would see somebody that I knew in public with a necklace on. And it was just a small, it wasn't like a gaudy thing, small necklace. And the day that I first got my ears pierced about 3 years ago was one of the best days of my life. It felt so liberating. You were saying about the Bible and how things are misinterpreted. The reason why Matthew 10 is called the first commission is because, from what I understand, it was meant to be temporary, that his apostles were leaving everything behind. Then they came back and he sent them out. He said, "Now take your script and take your purse and go preach to the world." So the part where they left all of their money and their families and their homes behind was intended to be temporary.
Oh, wow. That's incredible. And I'm sure there's a lot of that now that you're uncovering so much. And it doesn't mean also that for some people, they will feel like they have to kind of get rid of all of it in order to be free. And others will pick and choose.
Yeah, we landed in very different places with that.
Uh-huh. Oh, I would love to talk about that. Okay, cool. All right. So Kyle, let's bring you into this discussion. So let's talk about your family history and your experiences there, and then how you're approaching your belief system in a different way from each other, which is lovely that you have that space to do that also. Go for it.
Sure. Yeah. So I was born into a family that went back a couple generations as well. I'm not super clear on when exactly it came into my families, but I know on one side of my family, I had a similar story of somebody who was just looking and maybe was on tough times and found some traveling ministers and just loved it and went to their traveling ministry series of meetings every day for a week and decided this is what we're doing. So the whole family joined all at once. That was a great grandparent of mine, I believe. And then on the other side, I actually had a grandfather who was an ordained Methodist minister, and his dad had been an ordained minister as well and had actually built a church, which I would have visited. It's a coffee shop now. But my great-grandfather told my grandfather, well, they used to have theological discussions and talk about what they were reading in the Bible, and they read the Gospels as well and said, we're building a church to preach in, but that's not actually how the ministers went out. They just traveled around. Why don't we do that? And my great-grandfather said, well, there's probably something like that out there. I just don't know how to make it work. So look out for that. Maybe you'll see it someday. So when my grandfather met my grandmother, who was already coming to the meetings, she took him to one of our gospel meetings to listen to the preachers. And he said, oh, well, that's it. They're doing it. They're traveling around. They're having public meetings. That sounds right. And he actually received his ordination to be a Methodist minister in the mail and threw it away and never used it. And he joined the 2x2s instead and had a meeting in his home for as long as he was alive. So that's the history there. So I grew up in two families that had been raised in it. My parents raised in it their whole lives. And yeah, same kind of thing. Never really questioned it. Oddly, looking back, it's weird that I didn't, but but we didn't. Yeah, growing up when I was younger, I grew up in an area that actually had a lot of kids about my age, give or take. I actually grew up in the same area as Mike. So we grew up knowing each other. And I took very literally the, I think it's non-biblical, I'm not sure, a phrase that our ministers used to say, which is, you're in the world, but you're not of the world. So we want to keep separate. And I took that to be a very personal, spiritual thing too. So luckily for me, there were a lot of kids in my area who also went to these meetings. So I'd go to school and wouldn't see many of them, but I didn't have a lot of friends at school. I had 2x2 friends on the weekends. And so I kind of grew up in this community adjacent to the real community and didn't really interact with the real world other than going to school and for a little while playing some sports when I was younger and stuff like that.
Both of our dads were elders.
Yeah. I grew up with a Wednesday night Bible study in my home for most of my life and Sunday meetings for a little while. And all of my extended family, at one point, all of my extended family were all in too. Now that's not the case anymore. Many have left in the last few years, but all of my friends and all of my family in the 2x2s. Some in my dad's generation on his side had left, some of his cousins. And we grew up near them, but never really talked to them. Lived in a neighboring town, but never interacted with them because they left and they're worldly now. We like our own professing 2x2 people. We were very, very separate without actually being physically separate.
Right. Yeah. And so just as Kari was talking about what it was like for girls and women and the prohibitions and the expectations and the limitations, I'm sure those were things that were just commonplace. You were used to that. Were there any for men or for boys as well in any way?
There were. It was much easier to pass as a male. So the things that we had weren't maybe common necessarily back then anyway. So short hair, I wasn't allowed to have long hair. We wouldn't have worn jewelry either or to have tattoos, any of that stuff. I didn't even wear a simple bracelet ever. I felt very convicted to not do that because I was trying to show that I wasn't one of the world. I was very conscientious about my language and things. I wouldn't use profanity at all. Things like that.
No alcohol, no parties, no TV, no Christmas, kind of general.
Yeah. And also when it came to, as I got a little older dating and things, I never dated a girl that didn't go to the meetings because I knew if I'm going to build a life with this, I need to have somebody who's on board. I married the most 2x2 person I could find.
Uh-huh.
And look at us now.
Hello. Hi. That's me. Well, not really anymore. Yeah. I was. Right. Yes.
I dragged him out, kicking and screaming.
That's not what happened. Although that may be the story among That's some people.
Cool. Yeah, we will definitely get to
it's
that.
It's always the woman's fault.
Usually.
Right? Oh, yes. That is a very interesting thing, that it is the woman's fault, as seen by a lot of different religions. I have an issue when I hear that women are told they need to be quiet so they don't distract the men. And that happens even in some Orthodox Jewish services. Women have to pray quietly so they don't distract the men from their prayers. And I think, no, I'm not coming back. So I think there are a lot of times that women are blamed for things. And then sometimes boys and men don't always learn about how to take accountability, how to take responsibility. They can just say, oh, well, it's this other person's fault, whether you want to gender the other person or not, but just you take it off yourself. And it's an interesting thing to kind of take it back and say, no, actually, this is on me, or this is for us to share this moment where we may have lost control or I may not have been my best self. Let me look inward rather than just pointing a finger outward. It's a hard transition, I think. That's part of, I think, also being in the world, that you realize there are different social rules and laws and expectations and the need for people to see their own part in things. But I think a lot of boys and men are given a pass, like you're saying, in a lot of ways, but girls and women are not. I wonder, just in your own family system, Kyle, what did you notice just about the differences, even between your mother and father and the life that they had and the freedoms they had?
Yeah, I think in my family, it's interesting because I think there was the 2x2 structure, which is man is head of house, man runs the meetings, a male minister, a brother worker has more authority than a sister worker all the time, 100% of the time. If a question comes up, that's systemic. You go to the brother and you go to the oldest one. In my own family, I think it wasn't quite that strong. I think fundamentally it would appear that that was true. And maybe it was. My mom, I had a mom who was educated and had a very bold, strong personality. And so I didn't take that quite as literally, I don't think. And you can tell, Kari can reflect on that. But I think in hindsight, it shouldn't surprise me or anyone that Kari is very strong-willed and can be authoritative. What's the word I'm looking for? It's in a good way. I'm saying like you are a very strong person. Yeah, you're a very strong, independent, thoughtful person. And I think that in a lot of cases, that isn't the case. I think in around the 2x2s, I could probably come up with a lot of different families I knew that wasn't the case, where the woman was extremely submissive.
I was that way as a 2x2, though.
Yeah, I think you've probably internalized a lot of that.
I have 3 older brothers. And even within my family structure, it was very patriarchal. Education was considered to be too open-minded and liberal, like higher education, college, particularly for women. So I never got a college education. That's something that I'm working on now. And women were seen as emotional and weak. And pretty much my mom and I being the women in the family, if we showed feeling or passion or emotion, it was brushed off and written off as a silly thing that women deal with.
Yeah. And in my family, the women were educated, but always looked the part, always dressed the right way. And on any really important conversation, they'd have the conversation, but then the man would make the decision.
Yeah.
So at the end of the day, it's the same thing, I think.
You know, I had a reaction. This is sort of tangential-ish, where with the recent... We're recording this in June of 2025. So with, I'll say the recent, because it was recent, public spat between Trump and Musk was so interesting. This isn't about politics per se. I haven't hidden my bias on this podcast, but this isn't what this is about now. People started calling it a girl fight. And I thought that's fascinating because there were no girls involved. But still, it was like, you know, like if you're going to have this kind of public spat or someone's being emotional, that then they're talked about as being girls. That is really, really interesting to me, that that's part of, I think, our psyche, if you're emotional, if you can't seem to contain your emotions, if you're trying to get back at people, et cetera, you're somehow talked about as a girl. And I think there are a lot of girls and women who were saying the same thing too, because we're acculturated in the same ways, unfortunately. But that was very interesting.
It's also very infantilizing when two grown adult men are acting like they're having a childhood spat that people compare them to women.
The example you gave of the Trump and Musk thing, one thing I noticed about that was that people who are really big fans of Trump and Musk and are on within their political realms were saying this is a very tough masculine fight. This is how men fight. They were justifying it. When you code it as male, it's strong and aggressive and good. And if you code it as female, it's weak and emotional. And it's the same thing. They're both looking at the same thing.
That's such a good perspective. You're right. And then there are some who were saying, oh, our parents are fighting. Everyone was reacting to it. And the memes were just fantastic. Meme central. So moving on. So I wonder for you, Kyle, just growing up with expectations placed on you or pressure put on you to be a certain way. I know it was just everyday life, but at times, was it difficult?
It was at times because I was very conscious that I was carrying this responsibility. It was explicitly stated in our house to consider the impact of your decisions on perception of God, perception of our family. Like I say, all of my family was in. And so it was very common conversation. Like, we're all good professing, we call it people. We're all good two by twos. We need to be a good example of that. Every day I would go to school with the responsibility of, I need to be a good example of all of the things, my belief system, God himself, my family. And like I say, it was explicitly said in my house that that was an expectation. So when the kids at school were doing something that I wasn't sure if it was a good thing or not, I knew which way to go, away from the worldly part, back to the other thing. For us, we didn't go to movie theaters. We were very against movie theaters. Of course, none of us had TVs. I don't know if Press X mentioned that, but yeah, no school dances. There was a lot of worldly, quote unquote, things that we just weren't allowed to do. And so that's where I drew the line. And anytime I wasn't sure, I just took the most conservative route. I kind of mentioned it in the past as like having a virus running on your brain all the time. That's just correcting what you do all the time. You've got the real world that you're interacting with, but you also have this internal world that's commenting on it all the time and making little corrections as you go to like, nope, steer back to your version of belief all the time. We've joked in the past about how it would have been better to be brought up on a commune somewhere, because then at least we wouldn't have all the pressure. We'd just be surrounded by our people. Now, like I say, luckily I had a lot of people around, but I didn't go to school with a lot of them. So I kind of had this two sets of books running on my head. The accounting was the same, but there were two sets.
A lot of people will talk about that. I think about people who are part of minority groups or people who are of different races or whatever it is. And they'll say they feel they have to try harder. They have to act a certain way. They have to keep that in mind, that they have to come across a certain way because they can't misstep even for a moment. That is a lot of pressure. Was there this worry for both of you, internalized worry, that if you did something you shouldn't do, that that would then be part of your reputation forever? Like, that's how you would be seen, or there would be the slippery slope, then you would just go into being sinful or being worldly. I just don't know if there was, some people describe it as sliding on ice, like there was no way to stop once you get started doing something quote unquote wrong or worldly. What was that like for both of you?
Yeah, that was taught by our ministers. The devil's very sneaky, and the devil doesn't look like a red with horns and a tail. It could just be some person in the world that's doing something that looks right, but really it's not. And really God hates it. So you're constantly worried about this spiritual overlay on society that's like winners and losers at all times. And the stakes are very high. You know, from a very early age, we believed in a literal burning fiery hell. So we were taught from the time we were children that making a mistake could lead us down a path and we might not even know it. We might be several steps down the path and not even realize it. So not only that, we had that running on us all the time, but also we were told many times, many, many times when I was younger, the workers don't get to talk to everybody. We, the children at my age, were the only Bible some people would ever read. So we had this responsibility of, if the people are honest, now not all of them are going to be honest. Most of the world's dishonest. We learned that. They're all bad people out there. But if somebody's honest and they come in contact with you, you might be the only Bible. You need to be on your best two by two behavior. and hopefully invite them to a meeting and they'll take part and they'll bring their family and it'll be a great story. And we were very conscious that those decision points along the way had eternal consequences.
I always describe the feeling as having one foot on the edge of hell. That's what it feels like constantly.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, don't trip. Don't stumble. And we were constantly afraid of being a stumbling block. There's a verse in the Pauline epistles about being a stumbling block. And I don't know what a stumbling block is, but
like a banana peel.
But it was very obvious. If we made a mistake, maybe we would recover, but we might offend somebody who maybe already knew, who was already a follower of Jesus. And if we caused them to stumble and then their path led them away, now we're responsible for their soul as well. You're trying to be a good example to the people who are worldly. You're trying to keep your own books in order. And you really have to be careful never, ever to offend anybody inside. And we can see now where that goes, where that leads to a lot of people never speaking up because they're afraid that if something bad happens to them and then they speak up about it, that might cause an offense. And that's way worse. So if you're abused in a group like this, it's so much better for you to not say anything than to cause an offense and have somebody leave.
And it's very insidious because they don't have written rules. A lot of religions have the Bible and then maybe also their own book. I'm thinking of like LDS with the Book of Mormon. There's nothing in addition to the King James Bible that really guided us in how to live and how to act other than what the workers would say. And all of the language is very coded. The language is very sneaky in the sense that since leaving, we've had to unlearn a lot of definitions, even something as basic as love, because love meant you had good behavior, you were earning it. It was conditional. If you had good behavior, if you did the right things, if you said the right things, if you checked the right boxes, then you were worthy of the love of your community, the acceptance of your community, and the love of God, but you had to earn it. But they don't explicitly say that necessarily. It's just, you know, the expectations that are on you, because when you see people step outside of that, you see the consequences. Language was not available around issues like mental health. So I grew up with pretty severe anxiety and OCD, but I didn't have language for that. I was and am bisexual, but I didn't have language to describe what I was feeling or to even understand that about myself until I was in 30s. So it feels when you leave the 2x2s, landing in a country, the world that we live in, where you don't know the language, but people think you know the language because you're speaking the language. So you kind of have to learn by a lot of observation and a lot of educating yourself. Okay, what does this term actually mean? What's the healthy version of love? What's the healthy version of acceptance or all of these things that were twisted for us?
And the gospel had to come through the spoken word of the ministers, which they don't acknowledge this now, but that's a doctrine called the living witness doctrine, which they adopted 100 years ago, which is the idea, this is why they don't print anything. There's no printed materials outside of a hymnal, which is actually their theology. They won't admit it, but that's what it is. And then a King James Bible, and they don't have any confessions of faith. They don't have anything written down. They have no web presence, and they don't establish themselves as churches unless they really have to for legal reasons in local areas. So for the most part, there's no rule book. And that's why you get a very, very conservative version of themselves all the time, because that's the safest way. You know this is true and it's the ultimate truth and you have to adhere to it, but you actually don't know where the line is. Nothing's written down. You teach people from a very early age, when you're raised in it, you're just raised doing this constant weighing of things all the time against like, if I get this wrong, it's eternally wrong. But if I do it kind of like they're doing it, it'll be right enough. So you kind of do that. So there's a normalizing regression to the mean around whatever the ministers are preaching at that time.
It was often preached to us that we are a sheepfold. And if on the edges of the fold, the wolves will pick you off. So stay in the middle. Right in the middle is where you are safest. And having OCD, I took all of these things very literally, very seriously. Yeah, I had a lot of scrupulosity.
So we had a lot of rules around things that weren't actually rules. I mentioned things like movie theaters. I wasn't allowed to go to a movie theater. Never in my life has someone said, don't go to a movie theater. What they say instead is, well, if Jesus returns, does he want to find you there? ... And so you ask these weird rhetorical, hypothetical questions and make very small children answer them in fear and trembling. And you get a very submissive group of people.
Right. That's interesting. You learn also how to internally answer those questions, even if they haven't been answered for you, because maybe Jesus would say, awesome, enjoy. What is it? The Ten Commandments? I'll sit next to you. I want to, you know.
Yeah.
That's cool. But I think it is really interesting how much you learn to monitor, police yourself. That's fascinating to me. I want to come back to the language in a moment, but also when you said there wasn't the language for really emotion, for feelings, for OCD, for feeling depressed, feeling anxious, all of it, even the idea of being bisexual and looking at it from a psychological or a scientific place, that it is part of a developmental norm within humans, that it's all along a spectrum, that there isn't the idea of spectrums and normalizing things.
Everything is binary, very black and white.
Good or bad, and really bad, not just like a little bit bad.
Yeah, hell or heaven.
Yeah.
Hell or heaven, yeah. Which is how it's seen, I think, still in a lot of different religious contexts or within certain countries, where there are certain countries where they'll say, there's no one here who's homosexual. It doesn't exist. I'm thinking, yeah, right. No. Evolutionarily speaking, everything exists. And there must be a reason that it all exists. And to normalize it is okay. It doesn't make things go haywire. I think there is this lack of ability to control the masses when things are along a spectrum. I don't know what you think about that.
Yeah, I mean, I also had and have chronic illness, which was another thing that my family was very skeptical of modern medicine. I was taken to doctors, and it was also the 80s and the 90s, and was brushed off as something going on. It's in her head or whatever. I didn't even really have the word for anxiety, which was also there. And obviously, when you're having health problems and nobody knows what's going on with you, that's going to cause more anxiety. But the idea in meeting was, if you're in meeting physically present, you will be saved. If you're not making it to enough meetings, then you're, again, on the verge of hell. As I reached my teen years, and particularly after in my 20s when I was having babies, my health was getting progressively worse. And it was more and more difficult for me to make it to meetings. And so there was this very strong ableism, which again, I didn't have a word for, where Kyle and I as a couple and our children as a family were kind of being almost edged out of things going on in the 2x2s. Families with kids our age were getting together, and they'd be at gospel meeting together, which is the Sunday afternoon meeting where you listen to the workers preach to you versus being in a home. And that was where they would say, let's go to dinner, or let's do this event together. And if we weren't there because of my health, we wouldn't be invited. So we felt less and less welcome just because of my disabilities, which again, took me so long to recognize that that's what was happening, because I didn't have the language for it and I didn't have diagnoses. So what happened in my mind was, it became my fault. It was something that was wrong with me, that I wasn't performing enough. I wasn't a good enough 2x2. So we were being almost pushed out. Like, we weren't excommunicated, but it felt like we weren't in the correct circles either.
And sometimes there's good and evil, but then there's also just good and other. And if, when it's just good and other, you don't have to define the other as evil. It's just not good. It's not right. I grew up hearing the term in my house all the time, do what's right. You have to do the right thing. Well, the right is a specific thing. Other is everything else. And so
Either becomes evil. So it's a scary place.
It's the same thing, but it's like, I guess
you don't belong to the tribe.
Right. But what I'm saying is, you don't have to necessarily define it as evil. It's just not what we're doing. It's not acceptable. And so another thing along the lines of what Kari's saying, there's this concept around peace and seeking after peace. And they'll find all the Bible verses about peace and pursuing peace. Well, if you're doing something that you know doesn't necessarily jive with how you were raised, anything from something as simple as, can I have this toy at the toy store, to what is my gender expression, sexuality? If it's not what you see around you, there's a little bit of anxiety there. you bring that to anybody else in the church, they will say, you don't have peace, you need to pray about it, and you need to get back to being right again. So there's very little deviation in the expressions people have in their lives, because it's not that anyone sat them down and said, this is the wrong thing to do. Probably what happened, at best, if they were able to talk to somebody about it, which I often didn't when I was younger, I just didn't talk to anybody because I knew what the answer would be. What you would do is just do the right thing and the good thing, pray about it, and maybe this will all go away. This bad feeling you have isn't peace. Peace is right. You're feeling other. You're feeling some other thing. So we didn't have terms for it. We didn't talk about anxiety. We didn't talk about OCD. We didn't talk about things that would cause you emotional distress, because by definition, emotional distress is wrong. It's other. It's bad. It's probably of the devil. It's worldly for sure. So whatever you have, that's something wrong with you and you need to fix it.
Yeah, even having theological questions was seen as a lack of peace. So yeah. Even asking them questions about the Bible, if you ask too many questions, and the reality is the workers often didn't have answers, so it was making them uncomfortable. But even having questions was an indicator that you were questioning the foundation.
Yeah, so they would use words that they would co-opt, like peace and offense and revelation, and then things like questioning. Those were all bad. When you heard the term question, it was always bad, wrong. You just knew if you had peace and you're right with God and you're doing the right things, you wouldn't have questions. So if you have questions, you're already wrong.
Yeah. And by nature, both of us are very inquisitive people. Mm-hmm. Like, we love learning. So we always have questions about everything, and we want to see things from different angles and viewpoints. And really, an integral part of our nature was wrong and bad from the beginning, from an early age.
Yeah.
Children learn, right? They ask a lot of questions. I would have been shut down.
Yeah. And the way I process that, some people, now that we're admins in the X group, we see a lot of different versions of this. And some people, when that happens to them, they just explode and they're like, this isn't for me. I'm going to run away. I'm going to leave this all behind. For me, I was a very conscientious person. So I just pulled in on myself. I just turtle into its shell. I'm just like, well, I don't want to cause anybody to stumble. I'll just do the right thing. Even if I don't understand, I just need to be humble.
The idea of questioning is also so important. And I think about you, Kari, being in school too. I mean, that's sort of fundamental. Raising your hand and saying, how come and what is this about? And feeling comfortable with that and getting that positive reinforcement. Like, oh, good. That's a great question. And I've talked on this podcast about how there are big thinkers in the world. And some have talked about how even as they were raised by their parents would ask them, not what did you learn today, but what questions did you ask today? What did you say to acquire what you wanted to find out more about? It's about the pursuit of information, which is really interesting. But people who are defensive or don't have the answer won't think of it as a question. They'll think of it as being questioned. It brings up so much emotion. And so often you want to just say to them, while they're yelling at you with the, what I call the how dare yous, you want to just say to them, you don't know the answer, do you? It's okay. That's fine. Let's get over this moment. I'll go look it up. But you can't. You can't go look it up. You only have these adults around you to ask these questions. And if they're not answering them, there's so much about what I'm learning about the truth, the way, two by twos, et cetera, is that so much of it is murky. Like, it's not written down. Things are said in kind of parable and metaphor. And I'd love to hear more about how you left and life since then, and also doing all of this with people who have been harmed in the group. Can you give some examples of some of this speaking in a way that's not clear, where you have to glean the message? Do you have samples of that?
Yeah, I mean, one that comes up frequently is love the sin or hate the sin. Just ambiguous, often applied to the LGBTQ community. So again, it's not like they never really explicitly said it's evil to be in the LGBTQ community. The way it was taught to me was like, it's akin to a struggle like alcoholism. This is just this person's struggle that they have to deal with. And if you act on it, then you can be excommunicated, which people were. I have some friends who were outed before they were even ready to come out and excommunicated at a very young age, when they still believed that that meant hell. What's your thing that you thought of?
I remember many ways that they spoke in the gospel meetings. We've actually kind of joked more recently. We still call in sometimes and listen to them talk just with new ears. And I've said to Kari a couple of times, I wish I could ask them what they think they're talking about, because I'm not sure that they know because they have a way of speaking that doesn't dig very deep into even to scripture, which is kind of their job. They don't dig into and get the meaning out of it. They sort of refer to it. So we actually joke about how they don't tell a whole parable. They'll just tell a little bit of a part of one and then kind of give a lesson with it. I don't know if the listeners can be familiar with the story of the sower and the seed in the Bible, where Jesus tells a story of somebody who's casting seed onto the ground and some of it grows and some of it doesn't. That story is the perfect amount of vague because it doesn't tell you what about the ground was good. It just calls it good ground. And then there's stony and there's thorny and there's something else, dry ground or something.
Wayside
soil. No one knows what any of that means, and they don't add any clarity to it, but they do know that you need to be good and you need to not be these other things. So there's a lot of language around, are you a thorny person? Do you have a thorny spirit? Do you have an unreceptive spirit in some way? Well, again, what does any of that mean? Nobody's sure. Yeah, do you have hardness in your heart? Mm. Don't be a stumbling block for somebody while you're figuring this out. And so once again, it's all like, everybody just be good, be good.
Wow. This is a quotable, the perfect amount of vague. It's just so awesome. I feel like that's a t-shirt.
That would be a good t-shirt.
I mean, it's just so awesome. Like, what? What's so stressful about that is that if you get it wrong, it seems there's literally hell to pay. So why is it so vague? I mean, that would stress me out. And that would be very hard if I had any kind of anxiety or even if I didn't.
Well,
even wrong is subjective to which workers you have in your field that year. For girls, for instance, I can think of examples where a girl had a skirt on that was above her knee and the workers who were in the field never commented on it. And then the next year comes around, you get new workers in your area, which is what the field is like, an area of a certain number of meetings geographically. And so the workers move around every year. You get new workers in your area and the next round of workers might not be okay with it, might not like it.
Oh, wow.
What's obvious probably in all that we're talking about is that with the doctrine that they have, such as it is, the gospel has to come from the ministers, and the ministers therefore are called by God specially to come out of life and go be ministers. And they have all of the authority. So if you don't understand what they're saying, you probably need to go pray about mm-hmm. it. They have a lot of authority, but you have the responsibility. It's not a line. They also don't have the responsibility. The people with authority are essentially unchallenged, especially when it comes to if you talk about Bible stuff, which is what they do. So if you're listening to that meeting and you're like, wait, how am I soft ground or good ground or thorny ground? If you don't know, you got to go read and pray about it. You're not going to go up and ask them to clarify because that's not their job. Their job is to just bring you the word. It's your job to figure it out.
Well, and it's safest to assume that you're not, that your heart is not in the right condition and that you need to.
Yeah. When in doubt, you need to figure it out. So there's an incredible amount of responsibility put on the people to manage all of this. And without really good language or clear boundaries on how to do it, you just figure it out. You figure out what works for you. And at the end of the day, though, the ministers have the power. They have nearly ultimate power over you because they hold the keys to whether you're a member of the group or not.
I believed that what I was taught was, if your heart was basically in the condition that God wanted you to be in for all eternity, he would take your life and you would be complete. You would be done. So that was like a big thing that played into my OCD fears was I need to be perfect. But if I'm perfect too soon, God's going to take my life. I mean, that did happen when I was 28. I lost a friend my age in an accident on his way home from a gospel meeting. And the narrative around that was very much God saw his heart and he was ready. So God took him.
And the opposite's also true. If you say no to God about something that he very clearly told you to do, he might take your life there too. Mm-hmm. There's many, many stories. They love stories about people who didn't show up at one of the meetings, got in a car accident, had a heart attack at home or something.
Got cancer.
And yeah. So I grew up hearing from a very young age that if I said no the wrong way and God just accepted that as my final no, that's it. He can, you know. He's a very loving God. He can kill you at any time.
Oh my goodness. The stress. I don't know how anyone slept. How do you just relax? And I think that's also what happens sometimes when, you know, people come to see me, they'll say, I don't know how to relax. I don't know how to stop looking over my shoulder. I don't know how to just be okay. I don't know what that even feels like. And if that's also going to put me in danger if I relax. Just having done this work for over 30 years and talking to thousands of people about thousands of different kinds of groups, they almost all do the exact same thing in this way, that they tell stories. They give testimonials, first in a positive way, about how this has changed people's lives and how it's brought them whatever in a good way. And then also what's happened to all these people who have left and what's wrong with them that they've left, or what's happened to them, to their health, to their families, to whatever, because they've left, almost across the board. And it really is very cruel. And sometimes people will say, you know, I'm worried about running into people who are in the group because they're going to question me, they're going to judge me, they've probably heard terrible things. And what do I say? What do I do? And part of what I tell people is, if you feel okay in your life now and you seem happy and kind of settled and you've been able to do okay, you don't have to say anything. You can just be living in a way that, even in an unspoken way, fights against what they've been told about what happens to people who leave, like maybe nothing or maybe only good things. And so just be you. Be happily you and see what that does to undermine that level of, I think, fear-based programming about what will happen to people who leave.
Yeah.
Wow.
Hard to let go of that hypervigilance in your body.
Right. Right.
What we grew up with.
Yeah. It's very, very hard. And a lot of people also will say that they can't sleep in, they can't do things for themselves, they can't take care of themselves because that's selfish, that's of the devil, that's been given a lot of things. And so I'm sure you've had that as well, just being able to enjoy yourselves and not think the other shoe's going to drop because you're enjoying yourself. Okay, so I want to make sure we talk about how you left and the work that you're doing now and your life as it is now. But I know there's been this whole explosion of people coming forward. So I want to make sure just to talk about that and how that's also impacted you. So tell us the stories about how you left.
How do you want to tell it?
Well, COVID happened.
Yeah, we stepped away at the same time. And for health reasons, we were very nervous about COVID. But we were very in. In hindsight, I think maybe we had some doubts that we were processing, or just thoughts that we were processing, but I'm not sure it was clear to us at the time. We actually had our own little family meetings by ourselves when COVID first started. That's how very in we were. We were just going to tread water while COVID was going on, and we'll come back on the other side. But I think the time away and the conversations we had, and then probably some deconstruction that was already happening with us because of things like raising children and having normal lives.
Events that were going on at that time. I remember a big thing for me was when Philando Castile was killed, and I started really examining my ideas around racism. It leads to all of the isms. It leads to ableism and homophobia and unlearning all of that. And at the time, I was homeschooling our three kids. I started leaning more and more towards secular curriculum for them and learning about evolution with them, which was something I had never been taught, and the evidence for the real age of the earth, not the age of the earth I had been taught. And I was like, oh, this actually is making sense. There's a lot of science behind this that I had been taught that man's wisdom leads into a maze so that science would confuse you more and it was evil, basically. And as I started learning, I was like, there is more evidence than I was told exists. It made sense to me. And so I was trying to work that in with my beliefs. I kept moving the goalposts of my beliefs and how does this fit with the Bible? That's the most important thing. And then when COVID hit in March 2020, our individual meetings were shut down briefly here in Arizona, but still enough that we had just the physical distance from the indoctrination, which we previously were going to meetings three times a week. So going from three times a week to nothing gave us room to start examining these questions that we had been, as the Mormons say, putting on the shelf for a while.
When we were having our own little family meetings, I think some of them ended in arguments because we had our own structure and included way more debate. For myself, I think that I'm an engineer, so I was always sort of able to keep two sets of books on that. You know, in science is good, belief is good too. Having kids in hindsight, and I'm only saying this in hindsight, I wouldn't have thought this in 2020, but having kids made me reassess some of that on the fly as far as what am I going to teach my kids? I can sort of keep two things in my head at once. Like, yeah, that's an old earth, but the Bible's not clear. That's fine. Maybe some of the Bible metaphor, maybe it's not. Maybe it really happened. That's fine. And I could just do that. But when it came to having kids and having to teach them, all of a sudden I was realizing, wait a second, what am I going to teach them? And our oldest at the time, at a very young age, started asking us questions about things that were being said by the workers. And it's like, well, what do you say? Because the true answer is either they didn't know what they're talking about or they're wrong about that. But you can't say that. I had a little bit of that running on me going into COVID of what am I going to teach? What values does my family actually have? I'd also started just a little bit because of that, because that little crack in the lid had shown up. I was thinking, had already started thinking about like, well, maybe if the Bible is more not real history, maybe it's more metaphors and things, where's the line on that? Well, maybe I should look into some Bible scholarship about it. I told Kari a little bit at the time, but I also didn't want to cause her to stumble. So
it really bothered me.
She got very upset. And so I just kept that to myself. But on the side, I was listening to people who were talking about some of the psychological significance to the Bible, the mythology of it and stuff like that. So I was in a weird place anyway. And I realized that more now in hindsight. But then COVID came along and watching the messaging around COVID, the 2x2s had some very strange messaging around it. Some of them tried to do the right thing and space out and stay away from people and not spread COVID. Some didn't. Some thought that this was a challenge to our faith. And if we really have faith, we're going to keep doing everything just like we did before. And it hit me very hard. If the Bible's not completely literally true, even if some of it is, but I'm not sure, and I can't bring that into our meetings. And also the faith system is causing people to view COVID, which is having a very tangible effect on people. People had passed away already among 2x2s that we knew. If it wasn't helping them deal with that, what is it for? What good is this belief system that I'm not clear if I'm even exactly aligned with them on everything in the Bible? And now it's having a detrimental impact in a very tangible way. When I say it that way, that's more conclusion now than I had at the time. At the time, I was just shocked. Threw me into a really dark, what's the term people like to use about deconstruction? Dark night of the soul. It hit me very hard because I knew that any change, again, there's good and there's other. And I was definitely in the other category. And I knew that if I stepped away, knew is the wrong word. I think I felt like if I were to do anything but continue on seemed like a bad idea, but not continue on fails my wife, fails my kids, and fails my extended family because I'm in this lineage of people who believe the most literal version of the Bible. And we went through a really dark time. We together went through a very dark time.
Yeah, I think there wasn't a lot of communication between us in our marriage about our belief system because we assumed if you're a 2x2, you believe what the 2x2s are taught. And interestingly, when we did finally start talking about our beliefs, mine were much more literal in the sense of what the Bible taught. I believed every story as being very literal, even though there's a lot of contradictions. So there were things that I obviously wasn't paying attention to, but Kyle was more, well, maybe that's an analogy for something, or maybe that's a parable.
I was trying to make it.
Yeah, there were things that you were glossing over and moving past that really bothered me. And so during all of 2020, we really were deconstructing individually without a lot of communication. I didn't really know that Kyle was listening to podcasts and educating himself through Bible scholars. And meanwhile, I read like 70 books that year. I was just a sponge. I was letting myself learn about things I had never been allowed to. And there was an underlying sense of guilt, like I shouldn't be reading this, but I'm reading books from other theological viewpoints and I'm reading about racism and I'm just all of these things we had never been able to educate ourselves about before. And so I was very much veering fairly quickly in the direction of atheism. By November, it really hit me. It didn't even feel like a choice. It was a realization, like, I don't believe any of this. And I don't believe that I need the Bible to be a good moral person. Some of our closest friends during this time when we were really struggling were people like Mike and Abby who had already left meetings. And yet they had been our truest friends who had loved us through all kinds of different phases and beliefs. And so I was talking a lot with Abby during that time and some other friends who had left meetings. And I have a couple of older siblings who left before me. That was really helpful. And by November 2020, I told Kyle, I think I'm an atheist. And that kicked off a very dark and difficult 6 months in our marriage. I might as well have told him I'd had an affair. It was a deep betrayal. And his reaction to me felt like a rejection. And I think all of that was based on this idea we had been taught that if you have different beliefs in a marriage, especially if one of you is a 2x2 and one of you isn't, or if one of you is a believer and one of you isn't, your marriage is divided and broken and it will not work. So both of us were deeply afraid that the other was going to leave us. And we didn't really have the skills to communicate about that. So I know during that time, I had at least 2 instances where I was suicidal. Kyle was going through some similar feelings, but we didn't know till later.
At the same time, I think we didn't realize. I think there was a certain period where we both actually were, I would say, suicidal. In hindsight, we realized it was about the same time for both of us. We were just at a really rock bottom, very short amount of time. It's like, it was something I struggle with. It's just there was a time where I was like, this is not fixable. And by fixable, I mean functional in a way that my entire family will agree with it. And like, we've taken our entire lives from the time we were born is built up a certain way. And at the moment, that doesn't work. Now we're both in our 30s going, wait a second, what do we do?
Yeah, foundation of everything that we'd built our lives on from childhood and our marriage on had just been completely flipped upside down. You used disorienting earlier, and that's a mild descriptor, but a good descriptor of what it felt like. It was completely life upending to start deconstructing everything that we thought was true. So everything went under the microscope, including probably our marriage.
Yeah, it's hard to describe to somebody who hasn't been through it because it sounds weird. It's like, what, you changed your mind about something and you got really depressed? And it's like, well, I'm not just changing which team I'm rooting for. I'm not changing and voting for the other party. I'm recontextualizing the life that I was born into. I never chose this in the first place. That's the thing about 2x2s and probably a lot of similar religions is actually for 2x2s especially, they don't have very many converts. Most of the people in the 2x2s were born into it. The confused language, the weird manipulation of psychology and emotions and things like that, that is their first language. It's not a second language to them. That's their first language. The world's the second language. Mm-hmm. And so you've absorbed this stuff so wholly that it is you. You're changing who you are to step away.
Yeah, it is an identity crisis on a very fundamental level. And so I started individual therapy. We tried therapy together for a while, and that just seemed to stir the pot and made things more difficult for us. So I went into individual therapy, which really started helping me create kind of a new foundation for myself, a new identity for myself, separate from the 2x2s, and also helped me gain some communication skills that I needed for my marriage. And I think that was really helpful for us. And then eventually Kyle started therapy as well. And we just realized our foundation of our marriage is we're best friends. We love each other and we wanted to make it work. And we did. We both worked really hard and got through that difficult time in a way that I think brought us a lot closer. We have far better communication than we did when we were 2x2s. And then when I came out to Kyle as bisexual, probably summer of 2022, his reaction was so immediately warm and embracing and accepting and supportive and affirming that it really healed that part of me that felt rejected when I told him I was an atheist, that feeling of betrayal that we had both had. It was like we got to do a redo. And it was really something that was healing for ourselves individually and for our marriage, I think. And the conversations that came from that, from me telling him I'm bisexual and what does that mean and what does that look like for our marriage and how do I explore that as a married adult? All of those things just opened up communication for us in a way on a deeper level. And I think that was really healing.
Yeah, I think the trouble up front was thinking, hey, we're going on 2 separate paths. We're doing the same thing, but in parallel. We're not doing this together and we don't know where this is going to end up. And I think we're both terrified that it was going to end up in completely different, irreconcilable places.
Yeah.
And I think over time, what we did, this is what worked for us. I can't say this would work for everybody, but for us, I think we both leaned into embracing the idea of, no, we're doing deconstruction together. Where we end up is we don't have a goal. There is no right necessarily per se. There's no objective, clear, correct goal that we both have to hit or we can't get along. We're just going to go through the process together. And I think it's still our commonality, probably, mm-hmm. in a lot of ways. whatever comes our way, we're just going to go through it together.
Yeah. Yeah. And then in, was it, let's see, when did we start the group? It was January 2022. After going through such a lonely, isolating, difficult process without a lot of community, like there wasn't really an X2x2 community that was really open to any belief system. There wasn't anything large. There were some little groups scattered here and there that were open to both X2x2s and currently what we call professing people in the 2x2s. There was some websites out there for information and like a messaging board website that just weren't very active. So it was very lonely. There wasn't really anything that united the community. So I said to Kyle, what if I start a Facebook support group? Maybe there's like 50 other people out there who feel like we felt going into that deconstruction process. And like maybe they could use support. And Kyle was a little hesitant, but we brought the idea to Mike and Abby and they were like immediately on board. So the four of us created that support group and now it has 5,700.
58, I think right now.
I'm pushing 5,800 people. Blew my expectations out of the water. I had no idea how uniting and supportive it would be as well for me, but for the community as a whole and how much work would go into it. And what it would facilitate, which was the abuse crisis. If it hadn't been for our support group, I don't think that scandal would have gone viral like it did in the 2x2 community. There wouldn't have been a way to share it and spread it because it really was the ex community speaking up and using their voices and supporting survivors and giving people in the church a place to land. That's what started this tsunami of survivors coming forward.
Yeah, kind of like I said, Kari and I were brought together more when we realized that deconstructing was the process and that is the life. I think that's what the group is premised on too. The commonality of everybody is that we are the deconstructing group. At first, I was a little hesitant because I thought, well, I don't know if I want to be involved in something that's X and anti. I don't want to be negative. I want to be positive. But I quickly realized that the positive is a group of people just going through stuff, working through stuff with the common language, the understanding of each other's language and things, and sharing stories among people who will understand those stories and understand the language and the everything behind it. And then the scandal broke because of that, because now people are more ready to share their stories. And unfortunately, a lot of the stories are very dark. That's what's going on right now.
Yeah, I'm an abuse survivor as well. So I'm sure Abby went into this a little bit, but there was a time there when that letter was first released describing this minister who had already died, but describing him as an abuser of children and women. Following that, there was a time for several months where we were each getting a dozen messages from survivors a day. So it was overwhelming and triggering and so, so important that those people got to share their stories and have a voice and be heard. Many of them for the first time were sharing their stories with us and had been carrying that around for decades, some of them.
I mean, I appreciate you also saying that you're an abuse survivor as well. That's not something that was talked about. I'm sure your friends wanted that to just be your part of your story. But I'm very sorry that you went through that. And it sounds like you have a lot of company there and a lot of fellow support in that. At what point that happened to you? How old were you when that happened or when it started?
I was 8.
8. Oh my goodness. Okay. And so that is a very confusing thing to have happen, but also traumatizing and being in an environment where you can't talk about it.
And there's no language to describe it.
No language, right. Or you blame yourself because that's where this conversation started, that you put it on you, or girls and women are taught to put it on themselves. Oh my goodness. So how powerful that you have been able to be involved in this whole process of people being able to connect, people being able to get support, people finding the language, people being able to kind of understand that what happened to them was wrong and that they didn't play a part in their own abuse, that it really did happen to them. And that's something that even kids who were raised in households where there's divorce, you learn as a therapist to say to the child, this was not your fault. And that there are many people who say, but of course children know it's not their fault. Well, no, not necessarily. Sometimes they're told that they are, but also we sometimes are just acculturated to believe that we brought something on that was awful for us. And so I really appreciate all that you shared today and all the work that you're doing and your relationship with each other, which is just beautiful and loving and accepting and unconditionally accepting, which is quite healing. And I think as it should be. Let people know where they can find the work that you're doing, or if you have another presence online where there's information and people want to find out about it. Where is it all?
Mostly just the Facebook group. That's what we have time to manage. I have a YouTube channel called Cow Tipper Vern's X2x2 Podcast. It's an old joke that's explained in the show. Just little diaries. And within our group, there's a lot of people now who are releasing podcasts and Substacks and all kinds of things now. People are really starting to fill their voices and speak publicly. So if you're an X2x2 and you join your group, our group, you'll find a lot of great information.
Okay. And then we can put the link to the Facebook group in the show notes. So we got that covered. Okay. Thank you. Thank you so much for today.
Thank you so much for having us on. Really appreciate it. Yeah.
Thank you.
Very important to talk to you and really nice. And I'm so glad your life is where it is now. It's very nice and can also renew people's faith that that's possible once they leave. So thank you. Thank you. One more thing before you go. Thank you so much to Kyle and to Kari, who helped us through a very revealing part of their life and difficult part of their life, and really what was their entire life and their entire existence for so long. And it's incredible when you hear these stories of people who found their way out and held on to relationships. But it also means learning how to navigate being in a relationship, how to figure that out, how to know what that even means. When you're put together in an environment that defines you individually, defines what relationships are supposed to be, especially relationships in religious groups between men and women and the roles that you're supposed to play and how you self-define what's important to you and what matters and what kind of person you're supposed to be and what your goals are and what you're supposed to be thinking and what you're supposed to be doing and what is right and what is wrong. Oh my goodness. How do you then get out and figure out who you are, but also figure out if this is something that's supposed to be, if this relationship is something that is sustainable? It's a very hard question to have to kind of juggle about when you come out of this. It is really wonderful to see when couples lean in, they lean in towards each other and they find a way to have the strength of their relationship help them through this difficult time of real awakening. And of course, to make matters worse, then you have all of the information that was about, you know, this organization and all the things that were being revealed that is, you know, it's horrific and it's traumatizing and it just keeps coming. It is incredible that they have been able to sustain this. Going back to this idea about being defined when you're involved in a group, one of the things that really is defined for people is this idea of love. And that within cultic groups, what I've seen time and time again is that love is conditional. Love is something that is supposed to be earned. love is something that you have to work to deserve the right to have, because you're not born just knowing that you deserve it. There was a time that I was talking to someone who said to me, I was raised in an environment like that, and I'm still learning that I actually just can have value just by virtue of being a human being in the world, and I don't actually have to do anything to earn it or to deserve it. I mean, I want to be a good person. In my work, I try to be good and honest. In my relationships, I'm good and honest, but still, I don't think that I deserve love. I don't think I've done things to really even show that I deserve to exist in this world. I mean, these are the kinds of devastating things that people raised in certain environments walk around with that you wouldn't have any idea about unless you sat down and talked to them or listened to them on shows like this, listened to them on shows like theirs, so that you could hear how much they are juggling this idea of if they matter and if they should matter. And in this conversation with this man that I had, where he was saying he didn't know if he really deserved love because he hadn't done enough in his life, whatever that means, whatever that looks like, to earn it, to prove that he deserved it. And so I remembered that he told me when he was young, he and his family had been in a car accident. And of course, the church blamed it on them, even though it wasn't their fault. And according to the police report, it was absolutely not their fault. But the church blamed it on them. And that's always going to happen. Let's see if we can use something that's already a trauma, that's already difficult for people to live through, and just make it 100 times worse by making them feel like they somehow caused it by virtue of not only something that they did or something they were supposed to do that they didn't do, or they didn't do in time, or they didn't do enough of, or a thought they had that was sinful in some way. And, you know, a lot of these groups have a lot of these ideas, from self-help groups to Scientology, you hear this a lot, to Bible-based groups, to a lot of different places. And it is, I think, so torturous, because you, in so many of these situations, are stuck in this environment that is literally adding insult to injury over and over again. And he said, well, I knew at the time, because I was told this, that, you know, this accident happened because I hadn't put my toys away. And he was, I don't know, 5 or 6 at the time. And he has been saying that he has some obsessive compulsive behaviors. And I said, is it since that time that you think that the car accident happened because you didn't put your toys away? And he said, yeah, it did. I mean, it was sort of stumbling over. I mean, this is a person who already has a master's degree and has an incredible life, etc. But he's still carrying around these thoughts that he was given, because I think unless you really look at them and undo them, you can carry them around. And they can affect how worthy you feel or not, but also they can affect your behavior later on in life. And so he always makes sure to put his toys away. His place is spotless, to the point where it's been hard for him to actually find someone to date, because making sure everything is in its place sometimes takes precedence. But also he doesn't feel worthy of love, so that also gets in the way. So much of this has left these imprints that get in his way. So I tried to talk him through this moment to help him see that he was worthy and that he didn't cause this, etc. And it just occurred to me to say, did you go to the hospital after this accident? And he said, yes. He said, actually, my sister was really badly injured, and I was told that was also my fault somehow. And she was put in a medically induced coma for a period of time. And my leg was broken in a number of places and had to be set. And I said, do you think that showed that you were worthy? That your sister was worthy, that your parents, who were also injured but were able to be taken care of and released, were also worthy, that these doctors and nurses who didn't know you at all jumped in to help you. And if you weren't worthy of love or living, they wouldn't have done it. They would have just let you be. and let you be in pain and let you suffer. They know you were worthy. They knew it. They would still know it now. And in those moments, I think there is this light bulb that goes off that I wish so many people could have the chance to have much earlier on before something gets etched into your soul. It gets sort of written on your psyche, almost like in indelible ink. But to think it through and to think about the times that people jumped in to help, even if you think you did something wrong, they saw that you were worthy of help, of love, of compassion. And to take those in and to have those be meaningful. For Kyle and Kari, it is beautiful to hear about how much they love each other unconditionally. That is huge. It's huge for people to have that in their lives, but especially when people are coming out of a very, very conditional, in kind of non-inclusive, non-sympathetic environment. You have to prove that you are someone worthy of anything. And it's so unfair. So thank you again to Kyle and to Kari for bringing this story to us and also how much they're doing for the community to be able to help people be free and to help people get the compassion that they deserve and be able to be heard. And to all those out there who are fighting the good fight, doing the good work, getting the word out, even though it's hard and even though there's backlash, but it still feels worth it because it is. Take good care. I'll talk to you next week.
Thank you very much for listening. Please support Indoctrination on Patreon at patreon.com/indoctrination. Be sure to give us a follow on our social media. Find us on Facebook and Instagram using @indoctrinationpodcast. And for Twitter, find us @_indoctrination. We love hearing from you too. So send us an email at indoctrinationshow@gmail.com. And for more updates on the show, visit our website at www.podpage.com/indoctrination.
Love to travel? Capital One has a rewards credit card that's perfect for you. With the Capital One Venture X card, you earn unlimited double miles on everything you buy. Plus, you get premium benefits at a collection of luxury hotels when you book on Capital One Travel. And with Venture X, you get access to over 1,000 airport lounges worldwide. Open up a world of travel possibilities with the Capital One Venture X card. What's in your wallet?
Terms apply. Lounge access is subject to change. See CapitalOne.com for details.